Alan Kring Productions, in association with the Emergent Light Studio, presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, for spring semester 2022. Today, project analysis. And to begin our happy time here, we'll have a look at some numbers and see how much sadness there is. And a full disclosure here, I had taken a bear position, and I was up really good on a bear position. Then I got greedy and I kept the position, and son of a dog, if this stupid market did decide to come roaring up today, it just irritates me to no end, because I was up good on the bear position, and then the market decided to have a happy day. Now, this is actually kind of an interesting happy day, because if you look at the indexes and exchanges, Dow is up a nice, healthy 0.81%, and not surprisingly, S&P is up more, 1%, and the NASDAQ just is rip-snorting up, closing in on 2% up for the day. So this is a good day across the board. In other words, investors are buying equities. Crude oil, on the other hand, is beginning to make its climb. As I had told you, it wants to be higher than where it was. I mean, there was a lot of moaning and groaning because it had gotten above 100 and it was reaching for 110, and then we had that release from the Strategic Oil Reserve in the United States and several other reserves. And so that knocked the price down. Then you had lots of information that Russia was getting around the sanctions and it was able to sell oil and sell more supply because Russia was getting out and getting its oil sold on outside of Russia. Wonderful stuff. Supply goes up, price goes down. Well, now a couple of factors are coming into play. The Russians don't have much. They had a lot in reserve that they were able to push into the market. That's kind of drying up. And then there are other indications that we're trying to get countries that were buying the oil and buying other things from Russia to finally commit to the fact we need to stop this now so that all Russia will have left in its portfolio of buying countries will be China and a few rogue countries that are still in the old Soviet bloc. But right now, still, oil is going up. So the price that you're seeing now, which has gone below $4 a gallon, is going to kind of start finding its way back above $4 a gallon. Coming over here, here's what's interesting, is investors are putting money into stocks, but look at this. The metals have got some buyers, too. So money's going into the metals. And the 10-year bond is down 4 basis points, which means that bond prices are going up. So investors are buying bonds. They're buying stocks, bonds, metals. There's just money is being peeled out of cash, and it's going every which way, which is kind of an indication of a broad base to a positive sentiment, a bullish sentiment. Okay, we'll see how long that lasts. I hope it doesn't last too long, but here we go. Looking over here, very quickly. Oh well, London had a really bad spell there, and the market closed a couple of hours ago over in London. And by the end, they were getting happy too. Tokyo yesterday and last night was in a good mood too. So I mean, there is bullish sentiment, and it's more kind of global. So what does that mean? You can ask. You'll get asked 10 experts, and you'll get 10 opinions. Much as I've heard, there is some sentiment that we are coming to the end game in the Ukraine. The Russians have been chased clear out of the north of Ukraine, and now they are back to the wall in the Donbass on the eastern side, and there is about to be a full-on classic war, and the Russians are going to lose it. They're just going to be crushed. So that may calm down the war, at least for a while. That's good news. The economies of the world don't look too bad right now, notwithstanding the higher prices and the inflations. If we look over here at the yield curve, look at this. Even the 7-10-year leg is closing in on getting out of the inversion. I mean, the whole thing, you had a lot of, the leg was very long on the inversion, and now it's narrowed down, so only the 7-10 is inverted, and it is close to setting itself right. We're within one basis point of flattening the 7-10-year leg. So, does that mean there's going to be no recession? No, we'll have a recession, probably starting in the first quarter of January. I don't think it's going to be too bad at all, but you know, that could change depending upon politics and what happens with the war in the Ukraine. And if that expands, that could cause throw a major kink into everyone's analysis. But there you are. Okay, enough of that. Let me take you on a journey here. Start with this. There is, in chapter 12 of your book, there is a slight shift in terminology that had been used earlier. And I want to point that out to you about the terms we use, the words we use for risk of a company. Now, the market risk is the non-diversifiable risk of that company's stock in a well-diversified portfolio. From the outside perspective, this is what you are paying attention to. It's measured by beta. Now, the market risk, the non-diversifiable risk, sometimes called the systematic risk, and you should have this in your notes several times now, that is only part of the overall risk of the company. The overall volatility of returns would be measured by the standard deviation. This part is measured by beta. The entire risk is standard deviation. That can be huge. Like a stock like Apple, it's a pussycat in a well-diversified portfolio. But if you look at its stock price charts, that thing is a whipsaw up and down. Most stocks are. But you don't, if you have a well-diversified portfolio, that doesn't matter because all you care about is that market risk, the part that stays, even in a well-diversified portfolio. Now, over here, the book has generally referred to this thing called standalone risk. This is the whole risk, the entire risk. And we can. I do blood? Damn that vampire. I mean, she was a nice girl. Thank you. Now, if it starts to kind of do that, you know, give me a call out, you know, a shout out. Yeah, I do. I, you know, 1 year, one razor. Yeah, man, I want to get older, grow a real beard. Yeah, wait until you try to shave that damn thing. Oh. Sorry to gross you out. I know what I can do. I hate that. Will you let me do my damn lecture? Thank you for that, yeah. Okay, standalone risk. Okay, now, in chapter 12, they kind of make this distinction. Standalone risk, they say this would be the risk of an individual project. And then there in the center is what they call in chapter 12, corporate risk. This is the risk of the corporation. This is more of the diversifiable risk. The non-systematic risk, as it were. It's not in the system, it's in the company. This project risk kind of sits here on its own. Here's the thing, and I'm going to give you a couple of examples. Make sure that you know this. Projects in and of themselves are risky as heck. I mean, they are, look, for every project you take on, for every 10 projects, you might have two or three in a typical company that are actually winners. Even after they've done this analysis that I'm showing you, and I'm going to show you more of it today, it's just like, it's risky to take on new projects. And I can give you examples of companies that went through everything that I'm doing here, showing you what we should do, and they did it in some cases, in many cases, and it still turned out to be an absolute fiasco. And it hurt the company, and people even lost jobs or got demoted in some cases. I'll start with an example. A company that is very conservative, it's always done no fighter pilot stuff. In fact, the company would be Coca-Cola. Coca-Cola is an old company. Old companies do not play fighter pilot. They do things carefully. They're always seeking to reduce risk because lower risk brings up the stock price. Risk is a price suppressor, as a general rule. So Coca-Cola, in the 1980s, they had produced Coca-Cola for almost a century. And more people prefer Coke than Pepsi, the whole nine yards. And they decided it was time to change the Coca-Cola formula. They just asked the question, should we change it for a new world, for new generations, people who are not so stuck to old traditions? They did focus groups. And I mean, they spent a lot making sure that this change would be embraced. The focus groups clearly indicated that the new Coke would be a home run. It was great. People loved the taste of it. It was still Coke, but it was a little bolder. It was a little tastier. And so with this in mind, they did their free cash flow analysis, just like I've done. Year one, the negatives. Year two, year zero, the negative. The investment, year one, year two, sales, free cash flow, were going to go through the roof very quickly. No problems, positive NPV to infinity and beyond. And then they put it on the shelf. They took all the old Coke off, and it all went to new Coke. And it was a catastrophe. Almost everyone hated new Coke. It was the subject, back in my younger years, of jokes and laughter. God, is this awful. Ah, terrible. So the executives are just losing it. What idiots did these focus groups that said everyone loved it? So they got some new marketing analysts, and they did focus groups, blind taste tests, and sure enough, everyone loves new Coke. And yet when they bought it on the shelves, they hated it. And then they finally, it hadn't occurred to them. It was a psychogenic effect. New Coke, the word new, meant that it wasn't what they wanted. They didn't want new. You see, this is something that we have learned in marketing. Everyone wants to be wild and crazy. We're all into the new age. And yet almost everyone is a herd follower. Tradition. Group behavior is everything. When we talk to you about how this is a disruptive product and it's only for the wild and crazy, breaking all the rules, we know damn well that we're going to say that, but we're not going to break any rules at all to give you what you want. And so New Coke died very an ugly death, and there were some firings and a lot of demotions and all that kind of good stuff. And the company moved on from there and said, we'll never do anything stupid like that again. Pepsi had another little round with something called Pepsi Clear. And Pepsi Clear, it was clear, it looked like water. And in marketing studies, people really liked it. It felt like it was more healthier. It was kind of cool. A completely clear drink that tasted like a soda pop. And yet it collapsed. It was a catastrophe. So there you are. I can show you numbers all day long, but if you haven't thought about what these numbers are, how you got these numbers, what is the psychology of your market, what are the real life consequences of what you do, you may very well make a mistake, and that's where you folks come in. You have to be yes people in a corporation. You nod your head, but don't let groupthink completely overwhelm when there's something inside you that's saying, wait a minute. Now, you'll probably be thrown out the window of the building if you say that too aggressively, but just know that when I do this analysis, garbage in, garbage out. So if we haven't thought about what we're doing, you would be surprised at the bad consequences. One more quick example. McDonald's. I think this was in the late 80s, early 90s. They decided that they were going to add a very new product to their menu, something that you wouldn't think of for McDonald's, and you probably would never have thought of it if I didn't tell you they'd already tried it. They were going to start selling pizzas, the McPizza. There would be a personal size of it, and then there would be these ginormous family-sized pizzas. They did the marketing studies, test subjects, focus groups, the whole nine yards, and I actually ate some of their pizzas. They were fantastic. They were delicious. This is McDonald's. This is better than the big ones at the time with places like Domino's. This is delicious. And so they went full on balls. They went on full steam ahead to do that product. Okay? I didn't say anything wrong, okay? They got all of their, most of their franchises and most of their company stores, they put in the ovens. They got expanded their storage space. They got the supply chains in place, and they went right to it. Personal pizzas, family pizzas, wonderful stuff. And then something happened. They realized, first of all, that the large box pizzas, the family-sized pizzas, didn't fit through their drive-through windows. Oh. So they had to expand their drive-through windows in all of their stores. Well, so much for that negative free cash flow year zero. We got it in year one and in year two. And then the next thing is that the pizzas were being ordered quite a bit through the drive-through. And that meant, but the pizzas couldn't be made as fast as hamburgers and cheeseburgers and Big Macs. They couldn't do it. They couldn't put them, make a bunch of them and then just let them set on those sliding shelves. They had to make them pretty fresh because that cheese was going to get hard and then that flavor wouldn't be there. So they had to do it right. It would take easily 5-10 minutes to make one of these pizzas, a family size, and so they had people pulling up. Please pull up. Please pull up. Their parking lot and drive-thrus were not built for that kind of a major queuing of the traffic lines through them. And so you had people angry, pissed off, that they had to wait all this time and find some place to pull over while their pizza was being made. Then they had their employees running like chickens with their heads cut off all around trying to find because that whole dynamic had not been worked out in that time. It's a lot better now. Chick-fil-A is a great example of that. But it was a disaster. And so, end of the story, no more McPizzas. And you missed something delicious at the time. I remember back in the mid-1990s, I was in Georgia down there, and my daughter said she wanted a pizza, a McPizza at the window, and the lady said, McDonald's doesn't make pizzas. And of course, and noting that that had been set up after the fiasco and everyone had forgotten about that terrible thing that had happened. So there you are. Think about projects before you go charging out there. Now, I'm going to give you some examples that have to do with what we're doing now. The thing is that when you, let's go with replacement projects. Now, the classic way to do it is to say, all right, we were spending $50,000 on this, and now with this new version of it, we'll spend only $30,000, so we're net gain $20,000, okay? Replacement project analysis. Okay, that's a good thing. But do know this. Replacement projects generally are not going to last as long as originals. That's just an unfortunate thing. Now, obviously, if you're replacing, you'll probably go to a new technology. But if you're deciding, well, we're going to throw out what we're using and start with something new, you're asking for trouble. Many times, new technologies are transitional technologies. They are not old technologies that have proven that they can last. A great example of that is, well, for example, wind turbines. We see them all over the prairie. They're actually, I love them, they're graceful. I used to put them up at art shows, and then the anti-wind turbine people would yell at me. But, I mean, great thing. Well, you, when you're about 15 years older, 20 years older, those wind turbines, what's left of them, will be silent because the winds on the prairie are dying with climate change. And so eventually, within a decade or two, the winds will be below turn speed for the wind turbines. Transitional technology. It's good now, but don't bet on it for some century in the future. Another example right now is electric vehicles. The ones that are being used now, actually, their net cost is higher than the old internal combustion, fossil fuel, dirty engines. They just won't last. The technology is going to have to improve a lot before they become an enduring, durable technology. I'll give you an example of that here in just a few minutes. Does that mean that we don't go with new technologies? No. In replacements and in other situations, we need to look, and now I'm going to focus on mutually exclusive projects, which I did last time, but now I'm going to talk about something that's kind of important to pay attention to. This is especially true, and the backdrop is what I was talking about. Sometimes a technology is not going to last very long. So if you go to a new technology, you can make choices on which one. Do you stick with an older standard, or do you go with a newer standard, but fully recognizing that it probably won't last as long as if you replace with an existing technology? And so we talk about the idea of two projects, mutually exclusive, but one lives longer than the other before the shutdown. Now, this is in your ReggieNet. This is in your ReggieNet folder. Whoops, I don't mean to do that. And I'm going to take one of these off here for a few minutes and white it out for you. In this case, we have projects A and B. Now, A, these are mutually exclusive. You are going to choose one or the other. Now, you notice that project A has a longer life. Project B has a shorter life. Now, if you do the famous net present value of future expected cash flows, and we're going to use a discount rate of 8% here, and as you can see, I just used an NPV formula. You will see that Project A has a higher NPV than Project 2. So there's no question right off the bat, ba-boom, you are going to take Project A. The problem here is that Project A is a longer life project. It has a higher NPV. So it is almost obvious that you're going to, it's not almost, it is obvious that you're going to take the Project A, a better technology, it'll last longer before it would have to be replaced by something new. Project B is a flash in the pan, we'll have to replace it. or the parts to it have to be completely redone after 3 years. So the classic NPV analysis of these two mutually exclusive projects, A and B, clearly favors Project A over Project B. But we cannot do that. We have to do something called common life. We look at the common life, and the common life will be the life of the longer project. So the common life is Project A at 6 years. Common life is 6 years. We have to turn Project B into a six-year project. And it's actually kind of obvious. Just watch the math. It's just simple arithmetic. We say, all right, what if we do Project B twice? We replace Project B with Project B at year three so that it has the life of Project A. To do that, we would look at Project B on its own for its original life of 3 years. It's going to cost $30,000. In year one, it's going to bring in $12,000. Year two, it's going to bring in $18,000. But in year three, we're going to take its $5,000, but we're also going to replace it. So we're going to spend the $30,000 over again. We're going to get $5,000 out of the last of its life, but we're also going to put the $30,000 in. So the net loss will be, cost on the second round would be $25,000. $30,000 out, $5,000 in at the end of the life of the first round. On it. And then it's just going to be the project it was before, $12,000, $18,000, $5,000. We've created the common life. So doing common life, you start out with the originals, and then in the year of termination of the shorter project, you say we take its what it will give us, and then we spend the original amount again, and then we just repeat the cash flow, the free cash flow. That's all you do. And then we do the NPV of the common life B. Well, spank me. It's got a higher NPV. So even though A lasts longer and it was originally a better project than A, if we just do Project B twice, it comes out to be a better project after all. Well, isn't that interesting? Okay, so now let's look at the internal rate of return. The internal rate of return of the of Project A just equals IRR is 8.61%. It's not shabby. The original Project B has a better internal rate of return, but you have to be careful about that. Internal rates of return are sensitive to the loading of the cash flow. A three-year project has all of its free cash flow loaded to the front end. So this 9.04 shouldn't be taken too seriously right off the bat, because that's what internal rates of return do. They tend to bias toward projects that have their big cash flows early on. So I'm going to look a little suspiciously at that. Yeah, that internal rate of return does look better than Project A, but I have to recognize that that is kind of vulnerable. Well, what if I look at the Common Life Project B? Now, the problem with the Common Life Project is that I can't do a traditional IRR on it, internal rate of return. You see that sign switch? There's a second sign switch. Negative to positive, then positive to negative, and a third sign switch, negative to positive. And remember what I told you, is that if there's more than one sign switch, an internal rate of return is invalid. So what we're going to have to do is use a modified internal rate of return, that nasty little thing where you have to do all these, the present value of the negative, the future value of the positives, and then do an internal rate of return of the big negative at the beginning, zeros, and then a big positive at the end. Fortunately, Excel excels at this. The one thing that we do have to do, though, is we have to say there was a financing rate. That's our discount rate. But there will also be the reinvestment rate at which we reinvest the positives. So in this case, I'm going to say that the financing rate was the original 8%, but we can reinvest the positive free cash flows from Project B at 12%. And then I can do the modified internal rate of return, the MIRR. You say, all right, first you tell it the financing rate, that's the F2 up there. You tell it the F2 and the reinvestment rate, that would be the G2. And then we do the free cash flows. Let's have a look at this one. Oh, that's a darn nice number. And I'll tell you why it's nice. That 10.28% internal rate of return, that's above the cost of financing it. So, yes, Project B, NPV, MIRR, they're both saying go with the shorter life project. Go with it. Now, it can go either way. I could set this up so that you would see it the opposite way, all that. But in this case, the original NPV is just not going to be appropriate simply because they have unequal lives. And how do you correct for that? You just repeat the shorter life project so that they have the same life. And then you can go through the NPV analysis, which in this case is a yes. And you can go with the MIRR, which is a very guess. So in this case, we have a winner. Now, let me tell you about testing and writing an assessment. A question like this is just not going to work in a final exam or in a quiz. If I were to do this, what I would do is I would give you the problem the day before, so that you had a decent shot at getting it right, and then you get your results down on a note card or something like that to put on the exam. That's about the only way that you can do this, test on this on an exam or a quiz, because it's a little too intense for a typical undergrad course. Even, I don't know if I'd even do this in an MBA course, because they can slash my tires as well as you can. But this gives you a picture of this kind of technologies. Some are transitional, and you have to be careful about that. Is you have to ask all of the relevant questions. For example, with electric vehicles, the problem is that it is a transitional technology right now. The cars that are on the road now, they probably would be completely obsolete within 5 years, possibly even shorter than that. We have to recognize the fact that these transitional technologies, as in this case, might be right. But you have to go in with your eyes open. You can't just say, yeah, it's new stuff, let's do it. Here's an example of what happens when you jump too quickly at a technology. Real story, and not too far from here, and I had inside knowledge of how this works. There's a company, most people have never heard of it, but it is actually a significant player. It started out, well, maybe 40 years ago, this was just a little couple of states, they had operations. A company that takes farm cooperatives, buys them, and then it provides them with their seed, their fertilizer, their insurance, their transportation and logistics. Over time, the company expanded to the point where now it is actually it's multinational, because they are operating in 37 states and in Canada. It has gotten much larger. One of the problems with a company that grows is keeping the lines of structure clean. This company actually has several different ways that you could look at divisions. There are the divisions by state, divisions by operations. Do they provide the seed? Do they provide the fertilizer? Do they provide the insurance, the risk management consulting? You could do it. You could divide up the company in many different ways. Do we divide it by U.S. operations versus foreign operations? I mean, it gets to be kind of complicated. Well, one thing is clear. They have a heavy presence in transportation of their seeds, their fertilizer, and all of the other things that go with an agricultural company, a big ag company. Okay. Last year, the main company was informed by one of the regionals, we are going to all driverless delivery transportation trucks, the ones that carry stuff from one state to the other and all of that. Our seed, our fertilizer, all these things are going to be in driverless trucks. And they will do what driverless trucks do. They follow GPS, they follow the signals on the roads, and they do something called platooning. They line up, and then the front truck leads the platoon down the roads and the highways and all that great stuff. And then they peel off to their exits as they go along. It's classic, like a military operation. That's how it's done with driverless fleets. Well, the bigwigs at the main company, one of them is a risk manager, and she asked, did you know that not very many states allow driverless commercial trucks? Well, we hadn't looked into that. We want to just move forward. No, you are not going to be able to drive those trucks in those states. And let's see, those states are the ones with most of the agriculture. Those are usually the states that are not progressive in their legislation. No, you're not going to be able to drive. You've replaced all those old diesel trucks with these new fangled trucks that have no driver. Well, guess what? You can't use them in most of the states in which you are going to operate. You idiots. The second thing about it was, we got to find a way to do this. We're saving money. We don't have to pay them stupid drivers and all that health insurance and unemployment insurance and all that workers' comp. We got all that off our books. In other words, at year zero on the new project, the replacement project, was considerably lower because they didn't have to have those messy humans to deal with as employees, just robots and computers. Well, wonderful. Yeah, positive NPV, there was no question it was positive NPV. Replacement project for the old diesel, dirty, fossil fuel burning trucks and those drivers, it was going to be a home run, except that they didn't bother to look at the details. That's what I'm bitching at you about in this. Be the voice in the room that is not groupthink. Now, you can't be a jerk about it, especially when you're younger. But, excuse me, has anyone, something like that. Now, there was another interesting part to it, too. Insurance, risk. Do you know what happens when a truck full of fertilizer has an accident? It's an environmental disaster, especially with some fertilizers. Are any of you familiar with anhydrous ammonia? It is huge in the ag industry. They pour it on the fields because it causes the nitrates to bind and the crops grow. It's also one of the most insanely dangerous poisons on earth. As a matter of fact, when it's being put on fields, you can't have a high wind because if that anhydrous sweeps off the field, it'll wipe out a forest and anyone who's living in a community not far from there. So you have to be super, super careful with the stuff. Standing joke in the industry is fields have these giant nurse tanks, those white long tanks. Those are anhydrous. So the kids from Chicago come down here and fill up their giant buckets with anhydrous because it's used in the making of crack cocaine, okay? And then they drive up to Chicago and we find their dead bodies along the highway because the anhydrous ate their lungs out on the way back up there. Lol. Basic crime prevention the natural way, I guess you could say. But anyway, okay. Did you take into account that if you've got platoon trucks and the truck in front gets into an accident, then all those other ones that are carrying more of that stuff pile up behind it, and then everyone who's in the accident with them is exposed to whatever fertilizer, whether it was pig manure or anhydrous. Yeah, really great idea. Guess what's going to happen to your insurance bill? Because those are risky AF on the highway. A human driver is going to be a lot smarter, and he's not going to be sticking his nut to butt with the back to front with the trucks in front. He's going to be flowing along at a safe distance, and if there is an accident, he's probably going to be a lot more experienced than a computer is at figuring out how to mitigate the disaster that's happening in front of him. Okay, so great idea, and no, it's not. Be that voice that thinks about what great new technology, how wonderful it is, and then think about consequences. I don't like to say think out of the box because usually everything is in the box, but just know what all the things that are in the box before you go out there and think if it's new, it's better. I mean, look at me. I'm old and I'm better. Or not. Okay. Enough of that. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.